the best progressive rock album this year, I think, is the Virgin Suicide soundtrack by Air.
Yeah.
Now, people might be sort of raising an eyebrow at that. Well, Air's not a progressive rock band. Well, they are on this album, I'll tell you that. Mm. I mean, Air always had that element of sort of Pink Floyd meets Serge Gainsbourg, didn't they? There was a very sort of Gallic sort of approach to... And also, there's a lot of John Barry. John Barry seems to be another popular reference point this year.
And Mellotron.
And Mellotron. This album is absolutely... This is a Mellotron album.
Mm.
This is it's the main instrument on this record, isn't it? It's a classic soundtrack in the sense there's three or four themes which basically are interpreted across the 13, 14 tracks.
Yeah.
So any one of these 14 tracks will be essentially an exploration of one of these three main themes, which is a classic soundtrack trope. But the chord changes are incredibly Barry-esque and Bond-esque, aren't they? But the texture of the music, the sound of the record is pure progressive rock, isn't it?
It's got a lovely sound. Well, to me, it's kind of got that late 60s Floyd dreaminess and what it's got that Floyd had at that point. They were actually a good groove band. People always forget this, that, you know, you listen to Atom Heart Mother, and part of the appeal is that Waters and Mason may not be the best rhythm section in the world, but they've got a lovely feel and groove. This album's got it. And it's in a concise way. So, yeah, I love this album. And it was it sort of boom years for soundtrack albums. You know, for me, Cliff Martinez does Traffic this year, which is really good. But he comes into his own with Solaris a couple of years later. There's some really good people working in soundtrack music.
And it's interesting that this is obviously an artist that hasn't been known for making soundtracks, but the directors reached out to this artist and said, come and make a soundtrack. And they seem to have taken to it like ducks to water. I mean, just like I say, it sounds like quintessentially like a soundtrack record. So it's also got that kind of very dry 70s, you know, drum
it's
sound.
It's sort of timeless, isn't it? I think it's one of the things, isn't it? It would have been a
very
great
organic
soundtrack in 69, 82, 92 now.
Well, the album it reminds me most of is Floyd's soundtrack to More. It's got that kind of vibe to it. Yeah, I love this record. It's my favourite progressive rock album of the year. What isn't my favourite progressive rock album of the year is the King Crimson album from this year. It's my least favourite King Crimson album, and I say this as a massive Crimson fan. Obviously, I am. I love the fact that they're not looking back with this record in the production, except they are looking back musically. I think that's the problem I have with it, is that some of it sounds like Crimson by Numbers. There's even pieces on this record which refer back in the title. Yeah, yeah. Pieces like Fractured, which obviously is looking back to Fracture. There's a track called Lark's Tongues. Is it Lark's Tongues in Aspic? Am I making this up now? Or is that the
Fracture
next album?
Is definitely there, I think.
I want to say there's Lark's Tongues in Aspic part 4 or 5 or whatever it is.
I'm not sure that's
maybe
on
that's
this.
On the next record. Yeah. But then there's also these big kind of macho blustery blues tracks, Prozac blues.
It's the opening track. I think that's one of the weakest, partly because of the processing on Aging Blues.
The processing
voice
is the problem I have with this album.
Yeah.
The processing is the problem I have with this album. Everything sounds very cold, very digital. Everything I associate with Crimson sounding like a force of nature, a live force of nature, is gone in this album. It sounds like an album that's been pieced together in the studio. Everything's been played to a kind of click track and quantized. And it's a very unpleasant sounding record. It sounds very metallic. It
sounds very digital.
Very digital. I don't hear any of the kind of wood, sort of natural organic sounds that I'm used to hearing.
I quite like it because it's kind of got digital oversaturation. So you're right, it's very digital, but it's oversaturated as a sound. I mean, some of it I'm not sure about. You know, Prozac Blues I'm not fond of, mainly because...
Kitchen Floor Oyster,
Wax
sort of more...
Wax Museum.
Yeah, another more bluesy...
But I think Blue is an amazing vocalist. There's some brilliant guitar pieces. And what I appreciate about it is they've taken certain classic Crimson motifs and they've upgraded it into the digital language. You know, they used V drums on the original version of this and it gives it a very distinct sound from any other King Crimson album. So, and it also kind of brings back something I missed madly. I loved the 80s King Crimson, and he brings back that kind of counter-rhythm Steve Reich style minimalist guitar pattern in this album.
But he does it on... So I'm right, Lark's Tongues and Aspic Part 4 is on this album.
Okay.
So you've got an album with 7 tracks, one of which apparently is by a different band called Project X.
Mm-hmm.
Of the remaining 6 tracks, 2 of them, one of which is 14 minutes and one of which is... 9 are called Fractured and Lark's Tongues and Aspic Part 4. So there is a sense very much of compositionally looking back.
Yeah, though it's got a sound that is very much of its day, more so than most albums. And I think that's the difference that for me, you know, there were a lot of progressive rock albums that I know that fans of the podcast are going to love this year, you know, by the likes of Kevin Gilbert, Spock's Beard, and those things, Flower Kings, that sort of band. And they're all amazingly well produced, performed, and so on. But it's that aspect of the music that I'm not as keen on. You know, to me, it's kind of reflecting on the 70s in a way that slightly loses the spirit of spontaneity that you hear in original Floyd, yes, Crimson music, which I don't think The Air does. The Air album has got all the innocence and accidental nature of an early Floyd album. And the King Crimson album I like because they're still kind of pushing themselves in a way sonically.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I mean, I like the fact the album exists in their catalogue. It is my least favourite album in their catalogue. I think mainly because of the production, the sound, the sonics of it, and also the fact this bluesy bluster, which, to be fair, Crimson have had that in the past. I mean, Ladies of the Road, things like that. The bluesy bluster doesn't... It's the aspect of Crimson that I least...
I agree,
...enjoy. You mentioned there the Kevin Gilbert album, The Shaming of the True. I didn't know this record. I listened to it. To me, it's very clever. To me... I'm not going to say anything negative about it, but to me, it's almost like the archetype of what I think of as the American approach to making progressive music, which I don't mean this to sound negative, but it always sounds like it's got much more of a session musician mentality about the way it's been put together. It's very clever. I hear a lot of Gentle Giant references in this record, but much more squeaky clean and session musicianized than Gentle Giant would be.
There's an FM rock quality to it.
FM rock quality to it. And I hear that in a lot of some of the artists you mentioned a few minutes ago. I hear that in a lot of that. To me, this album almost, because I gather Kevin Gilbert was very much an icon that was looked up to by a lot of that generation of American progressive rock artists. I can hear the archetype in his music, this album, which I gather he was working on for many years before he passed
Nick DiVigilo, who's now in Big Big Train, finished it off.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant drummer, Nick, I think that generation of musicians, I can hear how this album has been very important to them in shaping their kind of idea of how... And to be fair, there is a very distinctive American approach to making... you know, shall we say 21st century progressive rock music. And I hear it in this album. This album to me almost could be the archetype for that. It doesn't appeal to me personally.
Well, it's also one of those interesting albums where it's kind of about idealism in the industry. I think it's a concept album about a character being spewed out by the industry because the idealism doesn't communicate. And what's strange is for that, it's a really quite accessible rock album a lot of the time, isn't it? You know, for something that, in a sense, is talking about idealism, experimentation, and so on. It's very clever musically, but it's not necessarily difficult for the listener. It's quite easy on the ear, a lot of it, which I guess is a gift. I mean, he came up, I think Kevin Gilbert used to go out with Sheryl Crow, and he's all over her massive debut album. So to me, was spewed out by
To me, it sounds like someone that's more at home being a session musician or in the studio. Everything is very, very clean, very beautifully played. It doesn't have the grain that I like, I guess, from the European, like a band like Air, for example. Let's move on to Aging Gracefully. You'd called it something much more derogatory. I've changed the name. Aging Gracefully. We've got a lot of records this year by...
What, do I call it Old Bastards or something?
Yeah, I'm not even going to say. It's so derogatory, I was quite offended on behalf of these artists. You've already mentioned the Patti Smith album, but Johnny Cash, American 3, Solitary Man, Both Sides Now by Joni Mitchell, Silver and Gold by Neil Young, which I do know, it's A.N. Other Neil Young acoustic album. It's very good.
It's a good one.
It's a good one. It's A.N. Other Neil Young acoustic album. Life Will Kill You, Warren Zevon, who we've talked about on the show before. I know you know your friend. Two Against Nature, Steely Dan, which sounds like a Steely Dan record.
Well, that's like they just, with the Steely Dan album, it's a bit like they gave up after Asia. It's the album that should have followed Asia.
Yes.
It just sounds like they've gone, you know, it's not Gaucho. I think it's slightly
closer
more Asia.
To Asia. Right.
It's almost like this is the follow-up, the natural follow-up to Asia. It could have been released a year after Asia, and it's really good. I mean, Solitary Man I love. I love that Johnny Cash series of albums with Rick Rubin, where he's doing contemporary covers. And then very old songbook pieces or old country pieces. His voice is beaten to shit and it really suits the material. And I think Rubin captures it beautifully. I think they're great albums. And, you know, there are always little bits of surprises with a Nick Cave cover or a Nine Inch Nails cover or a Depeche Mode cover alongside a classic country piece. So I really like them, and they capture something.
He's very good at that, isn't he, Rick Rubin? Yeah. Getting these old timers to, you know,
to do albums of a lifetime.
Yeah, to come back to form, and he's almost made a career out, speciality of doing that. What about these aging gracefully? We've got XTC's Wasp Star, mm-hmm. Naked Self by The, and I've also put the Q. You put it in another category, but I put it in this category because I think this is where it kind of belongs. Blood Flowers by The Q. And I say that because I think it's all of these albums, actually possibly with the exception of the album, which I think Matt Johnson did try and do something a bit fresher, but mm-hmm. certainly with the XTC album and the Cure album, there's a sense of them trying to make XTC and Cure albums rather than really trying to do something different. And to me, they sound a little bit tired. It's, to me, XTC really miss, I think they miss Dave Gregory on this record. They miss the flair he had in terms of the arrangements. And I think with The Cure, it sounds like they're trying to do Disintegration again. They're trying to do Pornography again. And is it right that this is sort of supposed to be unofficially part of the trilogy?
Yeah. Well, I think you're right in most of that, although I feel more strongly, I really like Blood Flowers, actually, because I think it has got a sound distinct from Disintegration and Faith and Pornography. And it's got, you know, maybe he just sounds so worn down in a beautifully Robert Smith way, and it's got a slightly more acoustic palette at times, a slightly more impressionistic piano. So I really kind of rate Blood Flowers, although I totally take your point.
No, I mean, I did, playing devil's advocate to myself here, I did say here, am I being unfair?
You said it was rubbish, didn't you?
No, I'm not saying it's rubbish, but I'm saying, am I being unfair? Firstly, because they're not that old. I mean, the Cure, they're XTC, they're probably in their late 30s, early 40s at the most, like much younger than we are now, you know. Yeah. So am I being unfair? But there's a sense that all three of these artists feel like they're trying in a way, a bit like we talked about with U2 earlier, a little bit like they're...
And I think it was perceived like that at the time as well.
They've been off on a few tangents, and now we're going to come back. We're going to come back because I think The Cure's previous record of this was it Wild Mood Swings?
Yeah.
Where they tried to be this kind of almost joyous pop.
That was almost their acting baby, wasn't it?
Yeah. And there's a sense with Blood Flowers, okay, now what people really like about The Cure is 17 seconds, Pornography, Disintegration. Let's make another miserable album where the tracks all run to 9-10 minutes. And it feels a little bit more contrived to me, a little bit less inspired. I feel the same way about Wasp Star.
I feel the same way about Wasp Star. I mean, Wasp Star really misses Gregory. And I think, weirdly enough, although they were trying something different, there's something slightly more orthodox about the compositions and the sounds. And I think Apple Venus 1 actually might be one of my favourite XTC albums. Yeah. What a great album it is. So partly it's a slightly disappointing XTC album, and partly they've just followed up one of the albums of their career. You know, Apple Venus 1.
So you know, historically speaking, they were supposed to be, those two albums were supposed to be essentially a double album together. They were supposed to be the orchestral pieces and then the guitar pieces. And for whatever reason, they got split apart. And in the meantime, David left. So maybe it's what could have been in terms of a double album. But I agree with you. I think Apple Venus. And so there is that sense of disappointment when you hear an album like Wasp Star, and it's like, oh, it's XTC back to writing fairly, you know, by their standards, fairly, I think, uninteresting guitar pop.
Well, this is the Apple Venus 1. They're doing things they've never done before. The textures, some of the chord voicings, some of the arrangements. You're never going to hear them in any other XTC album. Yeah. It's unique in itself and a great XTC album. This sounds almost like a bit like exactly as you said, the U2 album. It's a bit like, wait a minute, what are XTC? And it's doing it slightly without the charm or the sense of accident.
And without Dave Gregory.
And also, I do feel
like Colin Moulding by this time is really phoning his songs in.
Right.
I think no matter how much Andy might still be, you know, like inspired and, you know, really trying hard to write great songs, I feel like Colin's songs, particularly on this album, although his songs on Apple Venus,
again on Apple Venus, he's really good,
but the songs on this album, Standing In For Joe, just not great by his standard. And he's written some of the best XTC songs of all, lest we forget. So just not.
But the same even vocally, you know, it seems to me that Andy Partridge, Colin Moulding on Venus One, they're kind of stretching themselves. They're sounding better than they've ever sounded before. Yeah. And then it's almost like this is within them. It's almost like they've almost curled up in a ball.
Certainly Andy on things like River of Orchids. Yeah, definitely. Let's move on to the final category then, Tim.
Go on.
jazz. I've kind of lumped these all in together because there's not a massive amount of albums in any of these genres. So jazz, at least not ones we're familiar with, or perhaps we feel like we need to talk about. Jazz, minimalism, experimental music. There are a couple of albums that are trying to take jazz into a different place mm-hmm. in this year, and I love them. The Necks. Have we talked about The Necks on the show before?
No, I don't think so.
The Necks are, I mean, how do you describe that? Minimalist jazz. It's jazz without soloing, isn't it? It's about I feel like we've talked about this in relation to someone else. Did we talk about it? Maybe
Nick Barch,
yeah, okay. Yeah. I was just thinking, we must have talked about this before because I can almost hear myself saying these things before. The Necks are like Nick Barch, except they take it to an extreme of extended composition.
Yeah.
Most of their pieces last the entirety of a single CD. Hanging Gardens, their album from this year, which is the album I discovered them with, and I think it's still my favourite, is a 60-minute long composition where there are no solos at all. No one is soloing, and yet this is somehow jazz music.
Yeah.
But it's also ambient music. It's also minimalism. It's about creating repetitive ostinatos, but somehow with a jazz sensibility. And it's very hard to describe it. I think you have to go and hear it. But it's hypnotic. It's inspiring. When I heard it, I was blown away.
Yeah.
Because I've heard nothing like this before. Nothing like this before. This is jazz music. This is minimalism music, both of which I love, somehow combined. And it's also Australian. Maybe that's got an aspect of it too. I don't know. It's not European. It's not American. It has something which sounds alien to both traditions, American and European. What do you think about The Necks, Tim?
Well, there's another Australian band from this year as well, Dirty Three, who are another trio from Australia made an album, which in some ways it's a bit like a kind of jazz version of the Silver Mount Zion. There's a lot of violin.
It's on my list too. Yeah.
I really like that album. It's quite emotional. Warren Ellis, who eventually ended up with Nick Cave, of course. The Necks, it's difficult. I suppose I think the minimalist comparison is the closest because it's one of those albums that if you're listening to it for 60 minutes, it seems like nothing's happening. It's a bit like how people sometimes understand early Philip Glass. It's like, what is happening over 60 minutes? But if you were to put the needle at a different point in the song, you can see how it's developing constantly.
Yeah.
So there's no one groove that's the same. And that's how it's jazz almost in a way, isn't it?
That's a good way of explaining it,
You know, it's 60 minutes that sounds like it's the same thing.
Yeah.
But at every single minute, something shifts, maybe even every single second.
It's a living, breathing organism, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not like
relentless as well.
It's almost something you could imagine could only exist because of the influence of electronic music. But it is the antithesis of that at the same time, in that it is a living, breathing, changing, constantly evolving, constantly growing organism.
Yes. I mean, is it a bit like, you know, you're saying about Questlove, that when he was taking the drums,
being influenced by
exactly, that this is
DJ
a
culture,
jazz band being influenced by DJ
by
culture,
electronica music,
and electronica, and it's really successful. I mean, they're a bit like Sunno in the sense that once you get a grip and a grasp of them, the albums do blur
a little bit. They're very prolific. They've made about 25-30 albums now, and each almost every single album is a single 60-minute piece.
Yeah.
You're right. I think they do shake it up a little bit from album to album. Like the album after this, Ether, is beatless. It's just about creating little sort of flurries of sound. So there's no constant rhythm, whereas this has a constant rhythm all the way through.
It sounds like it's created in real time, doesn't it? Because, I mean, again, it's like one of the things when I listen to this, it's bloody exhausting. It's like, if this is recorded in real time, how did they do it?
Well, they've got live albums where they do this.
Right.
So they certainly do it. I think the difference between the studio albums and the live albums is they go back and they spend a lot of time processing the mix.
Right.
Whereas the live performances are just literally you're listening to piano, double bass, drums. So they're a trio. We should have said that at the beginning.
Yeah, trio.
They are a jazz trio. And they do a lot of manipulation in the studio after they've recorded these extended compositions. Whereas they don't do that live. Live, it is truly organic. Another sort of new development in jazz this year for me, at least as far as I'm aware, is doom jazz. Bourne and De Club of Gore released their album Sunset Mission, which I think is one of their definitive statements. This is a style of music which is like The Next, is not about grandstanding. It's not about soloing. It's not about the cult of personality. But this is about reducing jazz to being as slow and as melancholic and as loungy as you can possibly imagine. I use the word loungy because one of the things I think was a big influence on this kind of strand of music, and there's a lot of bands who kind of picked up on it. It never became a big thing, but there's a lot of bands that play this sort of doom jazz now. Go back and watch those David Lynch movies and Twin Peaks and the way he uses. So like the Judy Cruz songs from Twin Peaks, for example, reducing jazz to something slow, sinister. It's got this kind of sinister jazz. Oh, that's a good song. No. reducing it to something with that sense of brooding menace. Yeah. But it's all about slowing the, again, no soloing, slowing the tempo down to it's almost like, snail pace. And Boren and De Club of Gore, for me, are the front runners of this kind of scene. So their album Sunset Mission is a great record to check out. Slowing, doom jazz, slowing it down to a snail's pace, but beautiful textures. They use things like Fender Rhodes. They use Mellotron on some of their records. Again, you talked about the prevalence of Mellotron this year and that kind of Lynchian sense of something sinister is about
to happen. I think the Lynchian, it's funny because I'd never really heard of it until earlier today when you played me some of it and automatically appealed to me. I thought it was very beautifully done, but it was interesting. I was thinking Angelo Badalamenti, that was kind of coming to mind.
I think that's the starting point for this. Yeah. So there's a whole generation of bands that kind of picked up on that, the way Badalamenti and Lynch created their soundtracks, and it became this genre of... But there's also influences, again, from things like the soundtrack to the Ipcress file, I want to say.
Yeah,
the John Barry. John Barry, again, seems to be someone that towers over a lot of the music this year, casts a shadow over a lot of the music from this year. And Solid Ether by Nils Petter Molvær. I don't know exactly how you say his surname, even though he's on my last record.
Yeah, it's on your last
record. I don't know how you say his surname. Nils Petter Molvær. So he's interesting in the sense that we may have talked about this before, maybe not. A jazz musician that's embracing electronica.
Yeah.
It's embracing drum and bass. It's embracing IDM and combining it into... But this is more traditionally jazz in the sense that he is a soloist.
Yeah.
So there is still a sort of
grandstanding. And I guess Bill Laswell had done something similar in a way. I mean, yeah, it's sort of drum and bass and club beats with a kind of John Hassell style trumpet.
Yeah, but I think Bill Laswell flirty with it, but Bill Laswell, I always think more on the sort of funk.
Yeah, and dub sometimes as well with him.
This is definitely someone coming from the tradition of jazz music.
Yeah.
Using electronic music.
No, it's good. It's a successful combination. And it is, you're right. It's kind of got authentic jazz voicing, that kind of textural John Hassell influence on the trumpet processing, and then kind of club beats. And what a weird album to be on ECM. It really showed that ECM was sort of...
trying to...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Break the mold.
So the final entry on our list of jazz minimalism and experimental, and in fact, the final entry on our list is this one, Tim. Mertzbau... Mertz Box, a 50 CD set of Japanese noise music.
Really?
Now, the thing is, we live in an era, 2024, which we're doing a 50 CD box set is like everyone's doing it, aren't they?
I think no man have just done it.
In 2000, the idea that someone was doing a 50 CD box set of all unreleased music, it sounded like it was a joke.
Yeah.
I bought it.
How much?
I think it was about £300. It's quite good value. But inside...
Which is about £10,000 in 2024 terms.
Yeah, inside you get a little car, you know, one of those car CD changers, which has got all the discs in it. 50 discs. You get a book. You get a T-shirt, a Mertzbau T-shirt.
Yeah.
You get lots of... This is de rigueur these days in 2000.
I do like it, I've got to say.
You're interested in listening to it now, aren't you? I mean, it's Japanese.
Well, I'm interested in holding the bag, I think. But...
In 2000,
no
one would have dared to do a 50 CD box set. Now the world's full of them.
Well, Snapper release them every week.
Done a few myself. Yeah. So there you go, Mertzbau. Right, Tim, let's...
I've never heard that. I've not even heard half a CD of that 50 CD set.
You've not listened to it, no. I'm not going to recommend it to you or the listeners unless you're predisposed towards noise music. It is. It's hardcore. It's hardcore listening, obviously. Okay. 50 seasons. And I have listened to it all the way through. I think once. I have listened to it. And I love Mertzberg. I love Japanese noise.
You were sort of 28 when you started and 36 when you finished.
Exactly. Yeah. But what a fetishistic object that is, isn't it?
No, it's lovely. I've got to say, the object is interesting me a lot.
50 CD set. And again, yeah. I say that because then no one was even releasing 10 CD sets.
I'll swap you one copy 50. Of Slender Sherbet for that.
Slender Sherbet, the classic Momus covering Murmus at Momus album, yeah. Tim.
Yeah.
2000. It's a pretty good year, wasn't it?
Despite
my scepticism that I was not going to have anything to say about anything in the 21st century. And to be fair, we have done a couple of episodes in the 2000s already, but I think they were about 10 minutes long.
No, 2002 we did, and we were really excited. We were very surprised. Or was it 2001? I think we did 2001, and we loved it. 2006 we did, and that was a bit like 1992. We felt it had gone off.
2006?
We felt like it was a stale Karamak that had been left out in the rain.
Did we talk about ocean size, everyone into position, or whatever it's called?
You said that was rubbish, I remember.
Oh, I love that record. No, I love that record. So maybe it's just the first couple of years of the 2000s we like, because 2000 is looking like a pretty good year to me looking at this.
2001, great year.
If you were going to pick your favourite album of the year...
Goldfrapp's Felt Mountain, actually. It's just whenever I listen to it, I get completely lost in that world.
It is stunning.
It's sonically impressive, very sensuous. Her voice is great. Will Gregory's sense of arrangement and sound, superb.
I'm with you on that. I think that record is absolutely stunning and still sounds as good as it ever did.
Yeah.
Still sounds as good as it ever did. I love the Radiohead album. Of course I do. But like you, I think Amnesiac, the follow-up.
Yeah, that's the one.
Would be the one I would go for, which is 2001. It's got my two favourite Radiohead songs of the era, which are Pyramid Song and Knives Out. So for that reason, I'm going to say Kid A, very important record. I'm not going to put it as my favourite record of the year. My favourite records of the year probably are, like you, the Goldfrapp record. Ghost Tropic.
That's great. Yeah.
I think it's just an album that, again, exists outside of any time. It's just stunning. And I listen to it as a continuum. I listen to it as an album. And for that reason alone, I never get tired of listening to it. Other albums this year that I possibly would consider amongst my favourites, The Virgin Suicides, the Air album, is brilliant. And the next album, Hanging Gardens, is probably my favourite next album. As you say, a lot of their albums are a little bit interchangeable. This, for me, is just a little cut above. And in that sense, I think what they do is very important in the sense they've almost created their own sound. I'm going to say that's a very special record to me. Now, a little bit more difficult. Pick the album you feel is the most important or influential in the long term.
It might be Kid A, but then I think it's had a limited impact, partly because rock music has really not taken this.
I concur. I think it should have had more influence than it's had. And it's funny how we were talking about the influences had almost in a sort of retrogressive way of sending people back away from it.
Yeah.
Coldplay and U2 kind of go, sort of almost providing the anti-Kid A.
Yeah.
If that's its influence, obviously that's a pretty negative one. But I think it has had an influence on music, but not. I think you're right, not to the extent that you might have anticipated.
No, you know, whereas you can say that the Benz and OK Computer, they set a template for the next 10, 15 years of rock and indie rock, that sadly doesn't.
Yeah.
But maybe should have done. D'Angelo, maybe, in the way in
that's
which
the one
it's,
for me.
It's conceived. I think, you know, that perhaps might be the one you can hear in more latter-day music than any other album from this year.
I think so too. I think in the sense that it was beginning of that kind of whole generation of neo-soul music, the fact that urban music today is the dominant musical form, that record, it's brilliant. The production is brilliant. It's looking forward. At the same time, it's also drawing from the past. And isn't that what we sort of value the most of all on this podcast? I mean, that's what we're always looking for in a way, isn't it? The Eminem and the Linkin Park records in their own way have been very influential too, but influential on music that I personally don't like.
Now, Linkin Park, you could definitely hear it through the early 2000s, influencing a lot of bands, partly because of its success, partly because it was a great sound.
Well, and also ditto the Coldplay record. I think there's been no end of sort of bands that have tried to ape the Coldplay sound.
And again, what I like about Coldplay is that, you know, for a mainstream band, they have continually shifted
their
directions.
They've tried different things. And he just has got the most phenomenal voice, and he can sing the phone book, and it sounds good. And on that note, I think we can draw a veil over the year 2000. Unless there's anything else you want to say to
him? We didn't do readers' questions or responses, but we can do that on another occasion. Next year, though, I think we're going to discuss. We're going to go back in time.
I'm really keen to do 1968.
1968.
Yeah, there's a couple of records I really feel like I want to talk about that kind of are things that we areas of music we've not talked about on the show before.
Yeah.
And they're from that year.
It's going to go back in time 32 years.
Well, it's kind of the interesting period, isn't it, between Psychedelia and the Summer of Love and the sort of birth, the real birth of progressive music.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this little in-between period, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by that era, and I love a lot of records from that era. So I think we're going to do 1968 next year. So we'll remember to do readers' questions, readers' wives on the...
Yeah, we'll do that.
On the 1968 episode, if we're not dead by then. Thank you very much for listening. As always, I hope you enjoyed it. And it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Tim.
I was going to say bye-bye,
oh,
Richard. We never say this. We're useless.
What?
If you like the podcast,
oh yes,
please review. Please press like, because apparently it's something to do with demographics, algorithms, and Bill Gates. I don't understand.
Yeah, if we get good reviews, apparently the algorithm shares our podcast with more people.
That Bill Gates has got it on his airplane that minute.
Yeah, and Joe Rogan will be, you know.
And Joe Rogan will be inviting us both onto his podcast.
Yeah. Now, we are rubbish at that. We're rubbish at, you know, for years we were rubbish about actually doing this any regularity. At least we've fixed that. But we're rubbish at promoting ourselves, yes.
I was right to do that, wasn't I?
Absolutely right. My bad for not mentioning that. But having him mentioned now, can we sign off?
Yeah.
It's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Tim.
Bye-bye.